We will take questions now, and Ilan would like it to be a question at a time. And please, I'm bored with repeating myself. Questions, no statements. We want to listen to to Ilan as much as we can. So we have between now and 9 o'clock, as much
45
as that,
minutes.
45 minutes for questions, and then we'll have 15 minutes if you want to buy a book. Ilan is happy to sign it for you. It's $9.99, but because we like you, it's $12.99 tonight for you. No, so I'm only joking. It's $9.99. And can people want to ask questions? Go ahead and do that.
Yes, sir. You paint a very bleak picture of the situation. As you say, it's not changed significantly since 67 in policy. Where do you actually see it going from here? Because, I mean, I'd agree with you that the West seems pretty much not interested, that really Israel can do fairly much anything. I guess if they tried to massacre all the 1.5 million, there might be a few concerned voices from the West then. But short of that, can't they just... I mean, I know a lot have been driven off agricultural land, so they've become dependent on the EU, have had water cut off, have roads crisscrossing the area. So isn't there a point where you think they may hope that they might just leave, go over to Jordan or somewhere like that and try and drive them out?
Right.
Not drive them out militarily, but yeah. Just hope make it so miserable for them that they gradually...
Well, I do think that eventually this is the strategy. I think that what the Israelis learned in the last few months, especially with the Gaza Strip, is that their idea of being so powerful that they can ship people around, concentrated in one place, and make them leave another, has limits. And that's where they ran into trouble in a way. As far as they are concerned, I think that they know very well what they would like to do with the West Bank, and they think it's possible, which is divided into actually two parts, and have one part totally annexed to Israel, and the people, the Palestinians who live there, removed from that part to the other part. Now, the other part would be run even more efficiently as a prison, because it would have no Jews in it, and it would have it would be totally dependent on Israel's goodwill, and that's good enough. They don't need to see them, you know, being thrown out over the river. The Gaza Strip forms a problem for Israel. You cannot divide it into two. They thought they found the solution by taking out the Jewish settlers and creating a pure prison without any of the warden's families inside the prison, and that's what the whole disengagement was about. And to their great surprise, the so-called inmates react, and they even dare to fire Qassam missiles against them, and they are using the most brutal punitive measures against them, and it still doesn't help. The worry is that in the case of the Gaza Strip, the imaginative Israeli mind of punitive action has not been exhausted yet. And God knows what they are preparing. The only way out of it is you know, taking the story to the street, to the civil societies, to do what the ANC succeeded in doing eventually by dragging the government screaming into eventually imposing sanctions of South Africa. I don't see any other way. Definitely not in the near future.
No. just one question I've got is in relation to the similarity and difference between 1948 and 1967. I've read that in 1967 the attitude of the Israeli government was slightly different than in 1948 because they desired not just the land but a captive labour force. The Israeli economy had already developed, and so it wasn't just a matter of wanting the land without the people. They wanted the land with the people in the same way that the South Africans wanted the black population as a Bantustan labour force. Now, obviously, since the Intifadas has made that difficult, they've started importing super exploited labour from other parts of the Third World into Israel to replace the Palestinians. So, therefore, that, it seems to me, is like a something else in addition to what you've said. And the second thing I'd like you to just comment on is the wonderful and amazing books by another anti-Zionist Israeli historian, Leni Brenner, who has documented the extraordinary and virtually unknown history of connivance between Zionism and anti-Semitism, even to the extent of the Zionist Nazi pact called the Havara Pact, which and you can say a few things about this, but it seems to me that we don't know anything about this in this country, and it's even more dramatic and important that we know about this.
The first point you made, I did say that it was different. I said that that was my point when I said that they realized they cannot repeat 1948. It was very different. So if you keep the people and you can also employ them as cheap labor without any rights in Israel, why not? The moment that these laborers begin to object to their conditions, the Israelis stop their employment. I still urge you to accept the metaphor of a prison. It's like taking prisoners out of the prison to work. This happened in many prison systems. You take prisoners to work outside, and you bring them back to the prison. That's exactly how the slave labor market, Israel operated with the Palestinian workers, was executed. As for the point that Leni is making, I hesitate to accentuate it too much because I don't think it's a major point. I do agree that there is a certain uniformity of interests between a movement that wants to get the Jews from Europe to settle in Palestine and an ideology that wants to get the Jews out of Europe. Of course, they meet. And in a certain moment in the Second World War, there was even an alliance with what the Zionist movement would call the Satan himself in order to enhance the chances of the Zionist settlement in Palestine. I hesitate to do it, and that's my only criticism on Leni Berger's book. I think that the great success of Zionism is its assumingly normal behavior, not abnormal behavior. It would be too easy if that was the problem of Zionism, that it cooperates with anti-Semitism. The problem with Zionism is it's so well focused on one group of people, the Palestinians, that as my late friend Edward Said used to say, comparison of Zionism with any other ism will never explain to you what it is. Because no other racism, no other awful isms in the world was focused on one small people like the Palestinians. In that respect, the Palestinians in Palestine, the Israelis don't care about Palestinians living in South Africa. They have no interest in them. It's a very focused project, colonialist and racist, that has not ended yet. And that's, I think, where we should look at.
Question.
Can you comment on the effect that the recent opening of the border between Gaza and Egypt had on their thinking? And can you extend that to answering whether the Israelis, the Zionists, have factored into their plans the future development of the other states that border the two territories, Syria, Lebanon, three states, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan? I mean, they have no control over the future of those states. And if those states change radically, the whole picture, will it change radically, or will it lead to a worse situation?
Right. Well, the first point, I think that you have to understand the sort of collective psyche of the Israelis these days. The only thing they saw on television is Palestinian terrorists going to Egypt to buy missiles. That's the only thing that they saw. They didn't see people who are starved to death, who were looking for food, people who were imprisoned for 6 years and were looking for some fresh air. They saw a group of terrorists going to buy some weapons or to get some weapons, and you have to close it as soon as possible, to the extent that they forgot that actually they could have sort of developed an idea, why don't we push them out of these borders and make them an Egyptian problem? But it didn't. Nobody, not one of them, said that, of the major main pundits of the Israeli media. It was very clear that this is how it's taken. It's a breakout of the prison. in my metaphor. People broke out of the prison, you have to build back the prison, and that's what they forced the Egyptians to do, and the Egyptians are doing it, unfortunately. And luckily, the Egyptians at least opened the border in the last horrific Israeli aerial attack, and people were shipped to Egyptian hospitals. The second point, I don't know how exactly you ask it. If you ask me objectively, is it going to be worse for Israel if these regimes, I don't think that's what you meant. You meant, do the Israelis think it will be worse for them? Well, Israelis feel very in control of what goes on in Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria. After all, Israeli agents can go around in Damascus and blow up anyone they want, it seems, nowadays. They do the same in Beirut, and I don't want even to start to explain what the Israelis are doing in Jordan. So they, at least, I hope they're wrong, but if you ask me their perception, they feel that their Arab neighboring countries are not a problem for anything they would do. They can do whatever they want. The last thing that they have to worry about is Arab reaction.
Yeah, would like to know if...
can you speak up, please?
Yeah, how the opposition movement is in Israel. I mean, you mentioned it how in 1967, from the left to the right, everyone was a queen. And how it is today. I mean, if there are kind of underground network, which we don't know anything about in the West, because I can't think or I can't see that there are not more people thinking like you and trying to be active. And how is the Israeli government reacting to that? Is there something of pushing people into exile or something like that? That's the first part. In the second, I read about different groups from Israel and Palestine, kind of peace groups who are working together. Mm-hmm. And my question is can we see anything what can be beneficial, or do they achieve anything? Because it looks like whatever you do, it is so close, the system is so close, that there is no kind of leak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, there is, of course, a network of some organizations in the Israeli civil society that are very brave people who are trying to challenge not only the policy of occupation but the whole Israeli policy. They are very small in numbers. Their impact so far is insignificant. However, it's very important that they are there. Just even for the sake of history, it's important for our general humanity to know that these people are there. And it's good that they are there. Just the other way, just the other day, for the first time, one of them was invited to talk and to be interviewed in the Israeli television, a mistake I used to do when I was in Israel. It's always a mistake. You don't never know if it's a mistake. If they invite someone like that, it's always to court-martial them in front of the public. So it's not an interview. It's sort of, you have sort of three people interviewing them, but they don't interview themselves. You are accused of that and that and that. And in the minute you have, everyone does the same mistake. I did it as well during the Lebanon War. Can you hear me? I'm sorry, I was sort of slowing down. In the Lebanon War, I did the same thing.
You were in the front row, you know.
Yeah, what happens is that you start to defend. You say, no, it's not true, I'm not doing... And then they say, okay, thank you very much for coming from the studio. And then the commenter says something like, well, I wasn't convinced that they are not traitors. But you haven't heard anything about the views. And they do the same. And it's very, very frustrating. So their ability at all to get to the Israeli public opinion is very limited. But I'm glad they're there. My theory is that they have only a chance of impacting it if Israel will be treated like South Africa was treated during the apartheid days. Only if we make Israel a pariah state that do these groups have any chance of impacting. If we continue to do what we are doing now, that is giving Israel the benefit of doubt, and as Mushir pointed out in his introductory remarks, saying it's all mistakes. These are all aberrations. These are exceptional actions of Israel, not the usual ones. These movements have no chance at all of changing. Now, as far as the joint movements, I'm less impressed by them. I don't think this is the point now. I think everyone has to work in their own societies. I think in due course we will need this joint structure in order to build a joint state there. But I think now the mission is to change the regime. At least one change of regime we should support. And this is the one in Israel, Palestine. What was your second question? Or was this the second question?
It was the whole the prospect of...
Oh, yes, the tithe thing. So I think it answers it. It's a tithe system, and you have to penetrate it from the outside.
I've got seven people who want to ask questions, so before I take anybody's... before I register anybody for questions, I'd like to finish the seven people first. Then, so it's your turn, I think.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I'd just like to ask your comments on a couple of things. One is, I may be misconstruing what's happening, but it looks like Fatah is acting in some way as an ally of the Israeli government now, and if I'm right, and what, you know, if you have any comments on that. Another one, which is perhaps unfair to ask you because you're an Israeli historian, but the change in the Jewish communities outside of Israel was very radical since the founding of Israel. There was a very strong radical tradition. Overwhelmingly, the tradition was a radical one among Jewish communities. And that was poisoned to a large extent, I think, by Zionism and has been. I get the feeling, maybe I'm wrong, but I get the feeling that there is more of a questioning of support for Israel among within the Jewish communities, and it's less taken for granted that because someone is Jewish or Jewish extraction, that they're automatically going to support whatever butchery the Israeli state gets up to. And the hysteria around, I'm a member of UCU, the hysteria around UCU's motion, it's coming up again at the NUT this week, I believe, or not the same, but a similar sort of discussions. Those discussions, do they have an effect within Israel-Palestine? And do you get any, is there any feeling of hope from those? I've just been interested in your comments.
Okay. The first point the first point.
Can you repeat the first part?
I'm a bit tired. I'm sorry.
Comes with age.
It comes with the age. Yeah. It's probably a question I wanted to avoid. That's why I have a constructive amnesia. I don't interfere in the Palestinian leadership. It's up to them. But I do agree that at least some members of the PA could be seen the way you portray them. I'm not sure the Fatah, but I think that it's the structure. The structure of the PA is, in my metaphor of the prison, works in a way that sometimes serves the prison authority. It doesn't have to be intentionally, but it's problematic. I mean, I would dismantle the PA tomorrow. I think it doesn't help anyone. It aggravates things. I can't see anyone... cannot convince me anything positive comes from this structure called the PA. Secondly, I think that it's like the anti-Zionist small groups in Israel and the new sort of more progressive voices you hear among the Jewish communities. They are all very positive. They are more numerous than they were ever before. They're very small yet compared to the mainstream. Each one has to play their role, and each one needs something else. The ones in Israel, I said, I think need a lot of pressure from the outside. The one from outside and among the Jewish progressive sort of voices, I think need a better strategy to go along with the Palestinian strategy. So it's also up to the Palestinians to integrate them together in what used to be the model of the anti-apartheid movement. It was sort of a rainbow of groups with different impulses coming to the same objective. So I think that it's hopeful. It's hopeful because it's a very important group. If you ask if they have any influence on Israel, they don't. And the Israelis are inoculated. There's an inoculation. There is a kind of a self-immunity that allows them to have sort of this prism through which they look at anything which is critical if it comes from Jews, whether from inside Israel or outside Israel. It must be, they treat it as a pathological problem. Jews who can be critical of Israel, something is wrong with them. It doesn't stand to reason, and they will explain to you, it doesn't stand to reason biologically that members of a group work against their own group. And with this, they stifle the whole debate. So I don't think that has much impact. I'll tell you what has impact. It's political, cultural elite of Europe who tell the Israelis, you cannot be part of Europe because of the way you behave. This is something that would create such an earthquake in Israel that it would be better than 55 suicide bombs put together in one day. That's my feeling.
Hi. I was wanting to ask a couple of things. One is, I was wondering what you think about the kind of likes of the analysis of people like James Petras that see that the US intervention in Iraq is primarily being done on behalf of Israel and isn't about oil, and what you think of that. And the other question is about someone else who's kind of written a lot on this. Is, I don't know if you're aware of the work of Ralph Schoenemann and Maya Schoen. They did a book a few years ago, The Hidden History of Zionism, and I was wondering if you've read that and what you think of that.
Yeah. The point about Israel's involvement in the Iraq war, I think that because I'm an historian, I need more of perspective to come out with any reasonable and intelligent analysis of what lies behind the American invasion. My lesson from history is that it's never one reason. It's never one motive. So I'm sure that the connection of Israel is very important here. And the fact that so many policymakers who eventually decided on the invasion of Iraq were members of pro-Israeli think tanks in America, and it shows you the connection. But I would not underrate the importance of oil. I would not underrate the importance of the special mentality and psyche of President Bush. There's so many other things that should be thrown into it, so I would wait with it. Yes, I have read, only recently I must say, parts of it, and I think it's a good book, and it has many original, I think, chapters that some of us would come back later to them with the help of documents, and they definitely had preceded us with that narrative.
He's answered. Okay.
Good.
This is a bit of a naive question, really, but just as I've been listening to you and you've been describing prisons with 1.5 million people in them, I sort of blanch away from using these sorts of phrases, but that's evil. It's just downright evil. It's just such a calculating, divisive, evil thing to do. Now, how does the Israeli populace at large struggle with its conscience?
After all,
how can you explain?
Yeah, good question. I'll, since only you and I are here in the room, I'll tell you something which nobody else is going to hear. I want to call my new book The Bureaucracy of Evil. And my publishers are very hesitant, although I saw that they already published it in their sort of prospectus. So they try to get used to the idea, but they're still trying to convince me to change the name. Because The Bureaucracy of Evil is... Sorry. Bureaucracy of Evil, of course, comes from an association with the banality of evil of Hannah Arendt and so on, and they don't like the association to Nazi Germany and so on. I'm not sure yet. I'm still debating, but I do think the point of departure is it's evil. It's very difficult. The only thing I can tell you, it's very difficult to live in a society, and maybe this is why I'm here, because I wasn't pushed physically out of my country. It's very difficult to live in a society where the worst kind of evil by your best friends and neighbors is not seen as evil at all. It's very, very difficult. It's probably more difficult to be tortured, and it's more difficult to be imprisoned. But on a different level, it's even more difficult to walk around and saying, did you see what they did to this baby? Did you see what they did to this old woman? And your best friends and neighbors say, but they deserve it. What do you mean? There is no remorse. There is no humanizing of it. Very, very difficult, because these are very humane people on every other aspect. I mean, I know it. You live with them, so you know how concerned they would be if my boy or one of my children would be, I don't know, hit by a car or fall or would be bitten by a dog. They would rush and would do everything in their power to help. But they have no sympathy whatsoever on any level to things that their own children are doing as soldiers to the Palestinians. Amazing. And of course, it is an abuse of so many things, of the Holocaust memory, of the Jewish heritage, I think, and all these things. Now, what do you do with this? The only thing you can do, and I did, and I think some of us are successful in it, is, of course, if you sit with people long enough, the good in them comes out. But it's very specific. It means that you have to sit, and you can do it. It's successful. I did it. I know it works. You can sit with 30 people of your neighbors, provided you're willing to sit with them a whole year, every week. Eventually it comes out. It does. It does come out, because these are not base people. It's a base. It's an evil system. There are no evil people in my mind. They're evil system. And this is an evil system. And the people are find it very difficult to get out of it, because it has so many advantages and privileges. And it's not the worst system in the world. We know that. I mean, people are doing worse things. So that also sort of makes it more difficult to confront it. So it's a work from below, a very slow work. In the meantime, I come back to my main point. What before education and conviction and persuasion works, pressure and pressure works better. Sanctions work better. Yeah.
First of all, thank you for your clarity and your courage. Would you agree that the only just solution is a one-state solution? And given that Israel was created by Europeans for Europeans, would you agree that the way to achieve this solution would be by Europeans, especially now that the ethnic mix in Europe has changed over the last few decades?
Yeah, definitely. I would say yes to both assumptions. I'm for many years now, I support the idea of one-state solution. I think people are not evil, and therefore I do think Jews and Palestinians in a different regime and a different system can share the land and build a better future for all concerned. And I hope also this would be eventually a reality, not in my lifetime, in my children's lifetime. As for the second question, yes, I do agree. Europe has to play a very important role. It really is responsible in many, many ways for what happened. The choice of Palestine as the territorial destiny of Zionism is anyway a European Christian idea. Many people think that the slogan, a land without people, to people without land, is Zionist. Not true. Lord Salisbury, a British minister in 1840, was the one who pushed for it as a kind of what we would call today as a Christian Zionists. And from that moment onwards, Britain and other European powers, each in their own turn and own way, are responsible for the tragedy of the Palestinians, no less than the Zionists, who of course did all the things that they did. So I do agree. I also hope that other powers, emerging powers in the world, would play a counterbalance to the American policy.
You mentioned earlier that Israel sort of wasn't really worried about its Arab neighbours. In your opinion, what is it worried of?
Yep. Yeah. I tell you what it's worried. It's worried about, first of all, a change in American policy. It's very worrying to the Israelis. And they constructed one of the best lobbies in the world to prevent that eventuality, and so far they have succeeded. And they're worried about the European change of view. I think, connected to it, they're really worried from a change in the lifestyle and well-being of the majority of their own society. I mean, if the majority of Israelis would not have the standard of living that they have, they might doubt other aspects. of their society's being and nature. So as long as they can provide, and the three things are connected. Israel has such an amazing standard of living because of its connection with Europe and America, not because of their particularly successful economic system. And I think that worries them much more than any military threat. For example, you would think that they may be worried by the performance of their army in the summer of 2006, but you can see from their inquiry commission that they're not worried from the performance of the army. They're worried from the performance of that particular army in that particular war. In other words, they believe that it's a very good mechanism, but it malfunctioned and it has to be corrected. This is not a worry. This is something they believe they have the power to correct.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you something
in connection
with the latest question.
Yeah.
The failure in the 2006 war, do you think that the new generation of Israelis don't carry the same Zionist commitment and ideology like the generations before, which created the State of Israel and all the wars which they won? Is this linked?
Yeah. It's again, the historian in me challenges any solid conclusion of something that happened a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
We need 100 years to say anything about anything. For the sake of argument, and because I'm sitting down now here, so I can allow this. I would think that it's an interesting thought. In other words, two things I think came out in the Lebanon War from the military point of view, but I'm not an expert on military, so take it with a modicum of sort of a grain of salt. The first is that the Israelis were fighting for too many years as the wardens of the mega prison.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly they had to fight really like an army, and they were not particularly good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be an erosion that has to do from the fact that the army was used as the main wardens of the mega prison. So that's one effect. The second one is Israel, as you know, is a very highly technological country, and the army is very full of highly technological gadgets, and it didn't work against the fierce fighters of the Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
They were not impressed by computers and all kinds of war games. I mean, the Israelis looked a bit like people who come from parlors of computer games that suddenly have to really fight in the open. But it's possible. It's a big issue in Israel. On the one hand, there is an increase of the number of young people who want to go to the most, what the Israelis would call the most combatant units. There is an increase.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also an increase of young people who evade service. Not ideologically, by the way, because they're spoiled brats, the Israelis would say. I wouldn't. I hope there's something more substantial there. I would like them, I'm saying this because I would like them, but I understand they won't do this. I would like them to say, we don't want to serve in this occupation army.
Mm-hmm.
But no, what they say is, we like life in Tel Aviv and there's no reason to interrupt it in the age of 18, which is not great news for the struggle against occupation, but it's probably great news for these kids because they're going to have better life. But it's early days, I think, for knowing where it's going.
I
think you've more partly answered the question I was going to ask, I think, from the young lady at the back, but anyway, I have a little bit on it too. I mean, the oxygen of life for Israel surely is the American aid, isn't it?
Yeah.
You rightly said the lobby, they created the most efficient lobby on earth so far, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If you can sort of somehow diminish that oxygen, it will hurt the economy, as you just elaborated on. And I think that's the right way of approach, I think. When it hurts the pocket, you can hurt the individual, I think. Because violence does not get you anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing is that I want your comment on is this terrorism and 9/11 you pointed out was a distinguishing point,
mm-hmm.
A very important parameter. Because that since that incident, I think, the Israeli you know, oppression have increased because there is that connection of terrorism with the Muslims.
Right.
And I think as long as that connection, you know, is there all the time, the American public will always see the Palestinians as terrorists, you know, because they're Muslim, most of them. And so, you know, this is a very tactful, very clever way of controlling the situation, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How long will it last?
Yeah. Well, first of all, your first point, I do agree. I think that a change in American, not just financial support, but you're right, financial support is a very important aspect of it. The Israeli economy would be nowhere without the American support. But also the military aid and the international umbrella, definitely. But I would not underestimate the importance of the European moral and cultural support for Israel. It's very important for the Israelis. Official Europe, not the civil society. Official Europe, as you can see from all the book fairs that occurred in the last few months all over Europe, official Europe celebrates this year the 60 years of Israel's success as the only democracy in the Middle East. This is very, very important to the Israelis, highly important. Not to mention the fact that the new members of the EU are even more embarrassingly pro-Israeli than the old ones. So that's a real problem. The second point you made is yes. I mean, surely the association of terrorism and Islam, and then association of Islam with Palestinians, all works very well for Israel. But that's at least this is a new phenomenon. So I think if we will all be organized well enough, this is something we can change. Because there are things you can't change, or you are very, everything can be changed. But the things which are very difficult to change, because they've been there for 40 years or 60 years. This hasn't been there for 40, 60 years. It's a new phenomenon, and I think we haven't yet found a way to work on this together, because it concerns groups that find it not so easy to cooperate. The Muslim community in Britain does not easily cooperate with the solidarity campaigns of Palestine, the progressive Jewish communities, and so on. It has to work together because it's for the benefit of everyone, despite maybe differences of opinion on other issues. This is something we all suffer from. And this is not too late, I think, in the day to create a different association and point out to the real terrorists of this world.
We got three more questions. One, two, then three in the back. And I'm afraid we won't have time for any more. So, your question? Yes?
I can't remember meetings this size on the question of Israel 10 years ago, going back 10 years. I don't know if you would agree, but I feel that there's a much greater consciousness now of the question of what's going on in Israel. It's much more central to politics, and that's largely because with the anti-war movement, when 2 million people marched against that, obviously the people now see more and more that the question of Israel is central to what's going on here, is the core, the source of instability across the world. The anti-war movement was criticised recently in The Guardian, actually, but from the beginning, from the outset, it made the connection between what's happening in Iraq and being opposed to that and what's happening in Israel, and said it was essential to understand that connection. We'll be marching again next Saturday, saying the same thing on the 5th anniversary of the start of the war. I mean, what do you think of the criticism that the two shouldn't be related? And do you think that is essential?
Yeah. No, I think the two should be related, because they are related. I think the frustration of the coalition against the war from not preventing the war, neither even causing the withdrawal of British troops from Afghanistan and Iraq, leads to this, what to my mind is not the right way of not a very constructive criticism. If the only soldier that Britain has brought back from the battlefields is Prince Harry, it shows that the war still goes on. The wrong, immoral war still goes on. There's nothing moral in the war that Britain wages either in Afghanistan or in Iraq. This is an imperial war that I definitely think nobody should endorse. And the fact that it continues means that there isn't success yet. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't continue. And I think, yes, I do think things are connected. And let me give you just one small example. Just one small example. If Britain would declare, official Britain, would declare its recognition of the Hamas as the people who were voted in January 2006, it totally diffuses the kind of coalition that Britain thinks that it's facing between Al-Qaeda, unhappy Muslim youth in Britain, Palestinian terrorists, and so on. In fact, it undermines Al-Qaeda more than anything else. The inclusive British policy towards Hamas and Hezbollah changes the whole global balance in what is called terror and anti-terror. And this shows you the connection.
This is a bit related to what you've already said, but I was just wondering, if you could specify, like, how has your line of argument been reacted upon within Israeli society? And in general, do you reckon that Israeli society is equipped against your line of argument? And if yes, how so? Like, what are the mechanisms you see within society?
I think the Israelis, unfortunately, are very well equipped to deal with the kind of criticism that I voice. Because the whole, and that's a subject for a whole new lecture, which I will not give, but the whole nature of the Israeli success vis-a-vis the Jewish community in Israel is not about censorship. It's not about forced indoctrination. It's a mechanism that works very well from the inside. Nobody knows exactly how it works, but it works very well. People have self-censorship. There's no censorship. People have a very strong belief and fear as well, that if they would not adhere to what the political elite tells them that they should do, that they would face an existential problem. And with existential fears, it's very, very difficult to deal, even if these are manipulated, and they are manipulated in this case. So what the mechanism of such a society is to regard you as irrelevant more than anything else. Because you are a member of the privileged group, you cannot be put in jail and nobody can do to you what they would do to a Palestinian dissenting voice. This is impossible. That defeats the self-image of the society. But the second best is to make you totally irrelevant, that you cannot say what you want to say in any main stage, and you can only appear, as I described before, you can only appear as someone who is an exotic, insane member of a chit-chat program at best, or as a traitor at worst. It's a very frustrating, as I said, situation, because sometimes you even wished for a more robust kind of a reaction against you, because it would show that they care, but they don't. I think it changes. It changes when you are outside. That's one of the reasons I moved to Britain. It changes because in the outside, as one of the newspapers wrote about myself, but it's true about others as well, suddenly he's important. He's empowered there. He becomes a danger. I mean, I don't know if I'm proud or not, that Alan Dershowitz in his book wrote that I'm more dangerous to Israel than the Iranian nuclear bomb. I don't think he's right. But it shows you that they feel that, in fact, they would like to continue inside the society's irrelevant or insane. When you, from the outside, you may point to the insanity of the society. And that becomes more problematic. So I think the more we can recruit Israelis who are outside to do what they cannot do in the inside, especially progressive Jewish voices as well, I think we have a better chance of changing it.
The last question, and my apologies for people who raised their hands, we can't take more than one question. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a question, a past-oriented question, a future-oriented question. You said about American policy, the reasons for the American invasion of Iraq, that you always, as a historian, look for, you know, complexity for more than one reason. But your accounts of Israeli policy, if you like, and the Israeli approach to the Palestinians from 1948 to now, you give a picture of something that's very singular, mm-hmm. very single-minded.
Okay.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm wondering, around that singularity, what is the light and shade? What have been the changes or the evolution of it, or the differences that perhaps help us to understand the thing as a whole more fully?
Mm-hmm.
My future focus question, speaking as one of those pathological Jews that you mentioned, is if we're talking about lobbying and trying to change the way that the Western government treats Israel, I wonder how important you think in that Jewish communities in the diaspora are. So, for example, if you're talking about the states, to what extent is their support of Israel governed or sort of determined by the sort of geopolitical kind of stuff? And to what extent is it determined by the pro-Israel lobby in the US? And you know, any kind of thoughts as to how progressive voices might deploy themselves?
Right. Okay. The first point, I don't think I projected a very simplified picture. I think it's a very complex mechanism. In fact, my hope is that it's a tiring mechanism. I once wrote an article saying that the basic things that Israelis, especially, I wrote an analysis of the liberal Zionists. I said, this is the worst job in the world. You keep lying, and you lie every minute, so you end up lying to yourself. It must be very tiring. And in fact, I know, I've been there. It's exhausting. In fact, it's a very elaborate mechanism. I don't think it's a single sort of a very clear mechanism. It works in a very sophisticated way. You have to lie to the Europeans. You have to play with the Americans. You have to lie to your set of universal beliefs and so on. It's complex. It's complex. Unfortunately, and this is true about Iraq as well, from the victim's point of view, this is never elaborate. It's very simple. I was for a few years a member of the Communist Party, and I tried to, until I found out it's as Zionist as any other party in Israel. I once told them, you know, when you put the boot on the face of the Palestinian and you hold Marx or you hold the Bible, for the poor person, you know, with the boot, it doesn't really matter. He doesn't find much comfort from the fact that you do it in the name of socialism or if you do it in the name of Judaism. So in this respect, it's singular from the point of view of the victim. It's definitely very complex from the point of view of the victimizer. And finally, about the future and the American and so on, I think that if you take out from the equation the work of the lobby, you will find, I think, that the majority, the vast majority of American Jews are totally indifferent about Palestine. They're typical Americans. Americans are indifferent about the world. We have this notion of a global empire. Go around America. 80% of the Americans don't have passports. Did you know that? 80% of the Americans don't have passports, and I bet you these 80% don't know where Palestine or Pakistan is unless it's the name of a town or a city in a nearby state. They are totally ignorant about the world, like Barack Obama, by the way, but I don't want to interfere in American policies. And they're totally ignorant about the world. They don't know where the world exists, apart from a very efficient elite that knows and knows what he wants to get out of the world to keep what they call the American way of life, that namely to control 25% of the energy of the world. That's the only way you can keep American electrical bulb and air conditions and petrol station open 24 hours a day. Now, this, I think, shows you that the Jewish community is very American. It's very American. It's not American in the way that it's being, I think, manipulated and operated by the lobby. I think the lobby is very crucial for the way a certain group of American Jews that are part of the American political elite influence that elite's policy. So I don't think it's true about America as a society, and I don't think it's true about the Jewish community in America as a whole. That, to my mind, I may be wrong, I'm not an expert on America, but I think America has very two distinct communities. You have the political and social elite and economic elite of America that presently runs the world in many ways, and you have the vast majority of Americans that have not a clue about what goes on in the world and are not interested in the world. Good people, by the way, quite a lot of them. And I don't know if it's at all possible to show them, as some activists in America try to show them, that their own personal welfare is affected by the policies of the political elite. But, we have enough on our plate then to change the average American point of view on life. Something for my next life, not for this one.
Well, I guess many, many points came out of Ilan's talk, but I'd like him to concentrate on one point, which is extremely important. Unless we treat Israel as a pariah state, as a criminal state that Israel is, we stand no chance of influencing the Israelis or the public opinion or whatever. So we really need to be standing on strong grounds that we are dealing with a state which is criminal by every definition of the state as a result of what they're committing against Palestinians and as a result of what they're doing in the world in general. So this is extremely important, and thank you for clarifying this point and making it really, really focused. Ethnic cleansing is continuing under different banners, and we all know that. It's great to hear it from people who believe in it and who people are authority in this field. I just want to quote something from a report in Arabic, which was published in Al Asbu'. He regards Ilan Pappé, after speaking in Berlin in Germany, as more honest and frank than most of Arab and Palestinian politicians. And I second that, and I salute you for that. Thank you very much for that, Ilan. Yes, for reminding us, this is the biggest meeting we had with the speaker, apart from when we cook Palestinian food. It's different. So thank you for coming without eating any food, so that's great commitment on your side. I just would like to invite you all to the 28th of March. We have in a vigil to protest against the crimes against the people of Palestine, especially these days in Gaza, outside the train station, 4 o'clock. We'll be there 28th of March, not this Friday, tomorrow, the following Friday. If you're not on our email and you're interested in our activities, which are so many, please try to leave your name on
either the student group or
on the stall here. Hillary will be collecting for the course of the evening, and I let me warn you, don't get on the wrong side of Hillary, because you know, so Hillary will be there collecting for the course. We do need your contributions. And before you go, Ilan will be happy to sign books for people who want to buy this very important book, which I definitely recommend. And as I said, it's a very important document. So
yes, I will. Thank you.
Just to clarify, I'm going to 2 weeks tomorrow, not a week from tomorrow.
28.
Yeah.
2 weeks tomorrow, sorry.
Yes.
Thank you all very much for coming.
Yes.